Department of Religious Studies at the University of Kansas is conducting a research project that seeks to preserve the history of various churches and other religious organizations in Kansas. We would like to record your memories of your experience in religious organizations. We expect that each interview will take about 1 hour. We assure you that you are not obligated to participate and may discontinue your involvement at any time. Since we are trying to create a public record of Kansas religious history, we are primarily interviewing persons who agree to let their interviews be made available to the general public through a website to be identified by name as the person who is interviewed. Should you have any questions about the project, please contact Professor Tim Miller at 785-864-7263 or tkansas@ku.edu. If you have any questions about your rights as a research participant, you may call the Human Subjects Protection Office at 785-864-7429 or email mdenning@ku.edu. All right. So my first question is, what is your name?
My name is Joshua Lawler.
And can you spell that for me?
Joshua Lawlar.
Excellent. Oh, and today's date is September 28th, 2018. And what is the name of your church?
St. Nicholas Orthodox Christian Church.
Can you spell that for me? Well, you don't have to spell the same part, but the name.
Yeah, St. Nicholas, N-I-C-H-O-L-A-S.
Thank you so much. And what is the address of your church?
1235 Iowa Street.
Lawrence, Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
And can I ask where you're from?
I am originally from Kansas. My parents were both students at KU when I was born. And then I lived a few years in Newton, Kansas, a few years in Springfield, Missouri, and went to junior high and high school in Wichita.
And I know you already talked on this a little bit, but where did you go to school, undergrad, graduate school, seminary? What was your sort of educational background like?
So I wandered around a bit as an undergraduate, but I ended up getting my degree from K-State.
Mm-hmm.
I did a number of courses here at KU as well. But my degree is from K-State. I went to seminary at St. Vladimir's Orthodox Theological Seminary in Crestwood, New York, which is the main academic seminary for the Orthodox Church in America, just north of New York City. And then I did a doctoral degree at the University of Notre Dame in theology.
And what did you get your undergrad degree in?
English literature.
English literature. Can I ask, after moving around, well, you didn't move around so much, but you went to some pretty cool places, why did you decide to plant yourself here in Lawrence?
Well, my wife and I lived here in Lawrence before I went away to seminary.
Mm-hmm.
This is actually the community where we converted to Orthodox Christianity,
mm-hmm.
Which I'll talk more about in a minute.
Yeah.
And it was one of the places that we lived together that we thought if there was ever an opportunity to move back here,
mm-hmm.
this is one place we'd like to move.
Mm-hmm.
By the time we made the decision to move, we had four children.
Mm-hmm.
Lawrence is an easy place to live with children. We liked the town.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, both of our parents still lived in Wichita, so there's family connections. And, you know, we both are from Kansas, and we do like it here. There happened to be the parish needed a priest,
mm-hmm.
and I was able to start teaching part-time in religious studies as well at the same time. So I was able to continue a bit of an academic existence and also be the priest here. So the sort of combination of need for a priest, our interest in living in this area as a family, and then the chance to be kind of part-time involved at KU as well.
Definitely. That's cool. Can you give me just a brief history of the OCA and maybe a brief history of this church being part of the OCA or the OCA in this area, the Kansas area, you know,
sure.
However you want to.
So the Orthodox Church in America is one of many jurisdictions of Orthodox Christianity, all of which are in communion with each other,
mm-hmm.
but are governed separately because of ethnic connections. The Orthodox Church in America takes its historical root from the Russian Orthodox Church, and the sort of official history, at least in the kind of hagiographic memory of the OCA, is it all started in Alaska. There was a Russian mission in Alaska after a number of, probably decades of sort of intermarriage between Russian traders and adventurers and native Alaskans. The Russian Orthodox Church sent priests and monks to serve the Russians who were there, both by way of serving Russian people, but then and also by way of evangelistic outreach, that kind of thing. The very first mission was almost a total failure. There was a wreck at sea, and only one of the people made it actually up to Alaska. Herman, who was a monk, not even a priest. And he was canonized as a saint in, I don't remember what year it was actually, but 30 or 40 years ago.
Okay.
And he's regarded as the patron saint of America for Orthodox people because he was the first canonized saint to live here. Mm-hmm. He was a very humble monk mm-hmm. who lived amongst Aleut, Native Alaskans. So that was the kind of the beginnings of the Orthodoxy that would give birth to the OCA in America. Obviously, Serbs, Greeks, Arab Orthodox Christians came through immigration and so on in a different mode. But the OCA was a kind of mission, you might say, of the Russian Orthodox Church in America, starting in the West Coast. But then it also became very prominent in Pennsylvania, Ohio, big industrial centers, sort of a when immigrants started coming from Eastern Europe. Mm-hmm. They settled in steel towns, places that had lots of industry. Mm-hmm. And that, in some ways, Ohio and Pennsylvania are kind of the OCA heartland, as it were.
Yeah.
Lots of communities there. In 1970, the OCA was given its independence, if you like. It was made an independent church by the Moscow Patriarchate. Not without controversy. I won't go into that. But so in 1970, the Orthodox Church in America became a self-governing church. We consecrate our own bishops, elect our own primate, the head of our church, and completely govern our own affairs. So that's a very, very brief, unnuanced history.
It's a hard question to ask you. Can you give me a brief history of, like, you know, a whole thing? How about a brief history of this church in particular here in Lawrence?
So there have been Orthodox churches in this area for over 100 years. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of 100-year-old communities in Kansas City. They started out in Strawberry Hill in Kansas City and have since moved kind of to Johnson County suburbs. Mm-hmm. But a Serbian parish called St. George and what used to be a Russian parish and now is an OCA parish, Holy Trinity. And right. And so there's been Orthodoxy in this area for a long time. Orthodoxy as a culture has been well known in Lawrence in part because of the Russian department at KU. Mm-hmm. Not that necessarily lots of Orthodox people were associated with it, but you know, Russian Orthodoxy is central to Russian culture. Mm-hmm. And so many historians who work in Russian history here, and it's a venerable department here, mm-hmm. certainly are aware of Orthodoxy. So, you know, 30 years ago, there were certainly students who would come to KU who were Orthodox who would drive to Kansas City to go to church, mm-hmm. And so on. This parish was, so there was a campus presence here for a long time, and you know, Orthodox students would be here, and a kind of fellowship, you know, students would try to be together and give each other rides to liturgy and so on.
Yeah.
But as a parish, this community started in 2002, and from a small group of people. I was here when it started. Mm-hmm. I wasn't the priest, but I was here when it started. Mm-hmm. And it bounced around from, it was meeting in an apartment for a while. Mm-hmm. When it was founded as a parish, it was meeting in a little commercial space down at 9th and Illinois.
Okay.
Right next to Rick's Bar, actually.
Okay.
So that was an interesting time. Mm-hmm. The owner of the bar was actually kind of protective of us, and he would sort of keep his patrons if they were getting too loud or whatever at night if we were having services to mm-hmm. be quiet. So they were very good neighbors, actually.
Yeah.
So 2002 is when the community was founded as a parish.
Mm-hmm. 2002. And when did it move to this location?
This location, uh-huh. It moved in, I think, 2013, maybe.
Were you the priest here?
Yeah, I came here in 2011.
Okay.
And we found this property. The property as a whole has 3 acres. Mm-hmm. Half of that belongs to the church, and my family and I have the other half.
Yeah.
So when we first moved here, before my family and I moved into the house next door, mm-hmm. We had services in the house because this place was not set up for services.
Yeah.
So that first year we were in the house, then we used the summer to reorganize this space. Mm-hmm. And since then, we've been here.
Very nice. Thank you. Can I ask what the makeup of your parish is? Community-wise, how many men, how many women, percentage, converts, non-converts, folks from Kansas, folks from outside of Kansas, folks from outside of the U.S.?
Yeah.
What is your parish look like?
Yeah. I would say it's probably close to 50-50 male-female.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be a negligible difference. It's not a mm-hmm. noticeable difference.
Yeah.
We're a fairly young parish.
Mm-hmm.
I think no one in the parish is retired. We have some people who are getting close, but... Mm-hmm. So for an Orthodox community, we're quite young. It's mostly kind of young to medium age families. Lots of kids, probably more than 50% are under 18.
Okay.
Which makes liturgy interesting. Lots of very young kids. I mean, mm-hmm. probably of those kids, 3/4 are under the age of 12. Very young in that way. Many of the parishioners, probably most of the parishioners, are from Kansas. Some of them, you know, moved away for school and have been able to come back for work. Most of the community are converts, either from some form of Protestantism or, in a few cases, from Catholicism, not many, but a few, or from, you know, having no religious background at all.
Mm-hmm.
We have a few international people. Either Russian or Serbian. There's an Ethiopian woman who's in our parish. She's lived here for a long time, so she's as American as anything else.
Mm-hmm.
But we're mostly a convert parish, but not entirely.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly an American parish, but not entirely.
Yeah, totally. If you were to give like a number, like a percentage number to converts in your parish, what do you think you could do that?
Oh, it's probably, that's hard.
And yeah, I know.
By which I mean, you know, I'm a convert myself.
Yes.
But my children aren't.
Uh-huh.
But my family is not Orthodox.
Yeah.
So they're kind of like converts and kind of not.
Okay.
You know? So I would say in terms of literally who has only been an Orthodox Christian as a religious person,
mm-hmm.
I would say probably... it could be like 40 or 50% because
okay.
so many of our kids were all baptized in the church.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the adults, I would say probably 85 to 90%.
Okay.
80% maybe are converts.
85%
are converts.
Okay, thank you. Would you be all right if I asked a little bit about your personal conversion here?
Sure.
Excellent.
So I was raised in Protestant Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And in my formative years in junior high and high school in evangelical tradition. And my wife and I, after I finished university, decided to take a year off from being in the States, and we went to Ethiopia.
Okay.
For about the space of a school year, 9.5 months.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was planning on going into some kind of theological study, ministry study, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't have any children yet. This was felt like a good opportunity to do something practical
mm-hmm.
before just jumping in into studying academic theology.
Yeah.
We had some connections through friends over there, so we had a kind of an unlooked for opportunity to spend 9 months in Ethiopia. Ethiopia has an ancient Christian culture. It's the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. There are some, you know, ancient schisms between Byzantine Orthodox and so-called non-Chalcedonian Orthodox, which I'm not going to go into because they're not relevant here. But the point is, Ethiopia has been Christian officially for 1,700 years, and probably unofficially before that. And that really struck me. I didn't go over there as an evangelist. You know, I wasn't preaching to convert people. But there was certainly a presumption amongst, you know, some of the missionaries that the Ethiopian Orthodox were somehow less Christian. And that, I mean, to be honest, was profoundly offensive to me. Mm-hmm. And really shocking. Mm-hmm. And that really caused me to call into question what I was doing there.
Yeah.
You know, I found the Ethiopian Orthodox Church to be exquisitely beautiful, very profound, very serious, deeply ascetical, just ground into the very fiber of people's everyday lives. And at least my practice of Christianity felt to be very lacking, and I didn't think it was appropriate for me to be there as some kind of a teaching authority, you know. Mm-hmm. So I spent a number of months there really wrestling with that, and trying to do my best to keep my head above water, but I really didn't believe in what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
I am grateful for many of the relationships that I had, mm-hmm, with other missionaries. I mean, I met some amazing people who, the few that I sort of indicated my struggles with, were very, very gracious and didn't condemn me at all and were very nurturing, mm-hmm, and so on. But ultimately, you know, I left Ethiopia knowing that I wasn't going to continue in that form of Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't sure I was going to be Christian at all.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So we came back and we moved back to Lawrence, actually.
Yeah.
My closest friend was living here. I decided to study. I started taking random classes in religious studies and philosophy. I sort of did the college searching.
Yeah.
Then I didn't do it when I was an undergraduate. I was pretty sure on what I thought, and so that was a really rich time of reading and studying. And you know, my life was pretty stable insofar as I was married. We had our first baby right before we converted, actually. So we were kind of becoming a family, mm-hmm, in this whole thing. But it was not easy to wrestle with these basic questions of, am I going to be Christian at all?
Mm-hmm.
If so, how? Because I'm not evangelical, and I didn't believe in that,
yeah,
in that way. I had known before I came here that there was some kind of Orthodox fellowship that was in Lawrence. I didn't know if it was a parish or what. So I got here, and it took me a few months to find it, but I ended up finding the community, started to occasionally go to services, meet the priest. I was, you know, like I said, reading a lot of philosophy, a lot of religious studies. Nothing about Orthodoxy in university, but it all sort of helped to undo certain things,
yeah,
or to help me see things in a different way,
mm-hmm,
that kind of opened up when I began to approach the Orthodox Church. And I won't go into specifics about any of that stuff, but that's kind of the structure of how it happened. So over that, you know, couple of years of studying and a little over a year of pursuing an active,
yeah,
you know, practice, my wife and I decided to convert, or maybe was baptized,
mm-hmm,
in the Orthodox Church. And at that point, I mean, I didn't know if I would go on to seminary or not.
Yeah.
But, you know, it became pretty clear fairly soon that, mm-hmm, I wanted to at least pursue a formal study in theology.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to St. Vladimir Seminary, and about halfway through my time there, I decided to go on and get a doctorate in theology. And it wasn't until after I finished my PhD that I was ordained as a priest.
Okay.
And came back here. That wasn't required, but that's just the way it worked out for me.
Yeah, totally. Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing. Have you gone back to Ethiopia since?
Not since. Mm-hmm. I would very much like to. I'd like to go back as an Orthodox priest.
Yeah.
And be able to sort of be more present to that tradition.
Yeah.
But it's a beautiful, wonderful country, and a very hard country. I mean, it's obviously a lot of suffering and so on. But that was the first real turn for me was going there.
Sorry for switching subjects on you, but sort of coming back to present, can I ask what some fellowship activities are that you do here at St. Nicholas, either during, after, between worship services, church picnics, men's groups, women's groups, Sunday school?
Yeah. So the most important non-liturgical thing that we do is we actually have a full meal together after liturgy every Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like a kind of small thing, but for our community, it's really essential for us that we spend a lot of time together, not just in church, but afterwards eating together. We have a kind of teams of families who are assigned to bring food on certain days. And, you know, it's, again, these are sort of mundane realities, but our community is small, and we don't have a lot of programs yet, and maybe we never will. I don't know that this community is really a program community. You know, we're focused on praying and the practice.
Yeah,
we're not going to do like festivals and that kind of stuff. I mean, other communities do that, and they're very beautiful, but that's not really the style of our community.
Mm-hmm.
So having this full meal together, where we spend another hour and a half with each other after liturgy, just sitting and eating and talking, and has been a very grounding experience for our community. So that's the most important sort of every week thing that we do. We have a kind of a study group that meets once a week where we read books and talk about it. We kind of go back and forth between theology, literature, philosophy, depending upon what the people want to read. It's a very intelligent group, so we can read pretty serious stuff together, and that's very enjoyable. We actually don't have a lot of children's programs right now, again, partly because we're so small, and don't really have the space or the occasion for it. And it's something we think about, but it doesn't bother anyone too much.
Yeah.
Some of our families are homeschool families, so they're pretty active with their children anyway, and they, you know, have other activities and stuff, or kids that are in school are busy with school. And I don't feel a need right now to sort of build an alternate social culture for them.
Yeah.
I kind of want them to have to wrestle with the world in a certain way. I mean, there's a lot of garbage out there, obviously, but it's important that that they not be too insulated. You know, they need to... I think in some ways our worship space here kind of indicates that. We have Iowa Street just racing by during our services, so we sort of always are aware of where we are, and we're not trying to hide from the wider culture.
Yeah, I totally understand. I totally get that. This isn't on the sheet, so I apologize, but how are some ways that parishioners sort of become active in the church, besides just, not just worship, but besides just coming to worship services?
Yeah.
You have volunteers and reading, I don't know.
Yeah, so during services, our choir is a very important part of our community, and it's really quite good.
Mm-hmm.
We have some very actually talented singers, so for a small parish, it's a really big blessing, so people do that.
Yeah.
And then, people have to read during services, so there are a few people who, you know, are fluent readers who have good voices that can do that. So that's during the services.
Mm-hmm.
We also participate in Link, the soup kitchen. So we have once a month we go do that. So a number of our parishioners do that. we'll periodically have like work days for the parish. Mm-hmm. The land that we're on is very, very beautiful, but it's very overgrown. Mm-hmm. So we're often cutting down brush and clearing stuff, making things look nice, cleaning the church, these kinds of things. So those are different ways that people come. But then it's often just sort of ad hoc necessities, you know, when we, if a parishioner is having a child, mm-hmm. oftentimes other parishioners will make meals for them.
Yeah.
Those kinds of things happen. Mm-hmm. And the people see each other outside of church. I mean, they'll just hang out together, have each other over for dinner. And so in a way, like the parish itself doesn't have to be so dense in terms of activity, mm-hmm. because people are pretty active already.
Yeah.
And this is the one thing that we do here that you can't do out there, as it were, is pray together in the Orthodox manner. Like,
yeah.
They need church for church.
Yeah.
And I think most of our people are pretty active outside of it, and I'm happy for that. You know, we don't need to build a separate culture for them.
Excellent. Thank you so much for explaining that. I guess this is sort of same in the same thread, but is your church governed in a specific way? Do you have boards? Do you have committees? Or is it decisions you?
Well, the church at large is, it's a hierarchical church, so we have a bishop.
Yes.
So the bishop is the one who's in charge of the parish.
Okay.
And, you know, things that are maybe irregular that mm-hmm. I have to decide about in the community, you know, certain issues with respect to receiving a convert, marriage, mm-hmm. you know, something like that that is maybe not according to the letter of how things typically are done, mm-hmm. I need to call the bishop and ask mm-hmm. him for his blessing to do something or ask for his advice. And ultimately, you know, the bishops aren't heavy-handed, but mm-hmm. I am in obedience to him.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So it's his parish.
Okay.
And if he wanted me to go to another parish and he said, you have to go, then I go, you know. Mm-hmm. Again, bishops really don't do that in the OCA. You know, they work with their priests. They're not heavy-handed people, but that is the structure.
Okay.
So we have a bishop in the parish, you know. I'm the president of the parish in the sense that I do make decisions. Mm-hmm. Certainly liturgically, I set the schedule, all that kind of stuff. But we also have a parish council, so it's a board.
Okay.
And again, that's mostly because we're in America.
Yeah.
And legally speaking, as like a nonprofit, you have a governing board and that
okay.
kind of stuff. But aside from that, it's important that the priest have people in the parish that he can sort of meet with to talk about businessy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously just like the financial side of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't handle the money at all. We have mm-hmm. a treasurer and have all sort of procedures in place to make sure that it's all taken care of honestly and easily. All just, you know, these kind of basic things you have to do.
Yeah.
So, yes, we have a parish council. Mm-hmm. We do look after ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, the bishop isn't like calling every week and asking what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah, I gotcha. Can you tell me about some of your favorite holidays or occasions that have happened, story, favorite holidays or occasions that have been celebrated here, and how are they celebrated?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the biggest holiday, of course, is Pascha, mm-hmm. Easter, and that's a service that's all of Holy Week. It's a very rigorous, intense liturgical commemoration of the Passion of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, starting with Holy Thursday night, we're in church a lot, and most of the people come to most of the services. You know, people will often take Holy Friday off so they can be here all day Friday and Saturday. And then the Paschal Vigil itself starts before sometime close to midnight. We started a bit early because we've got so many little kids.
Yeah.
That because we have the Paschal Vigil, which is a long service in the middle of the night, and then we have a huge feast afterwards. So, you know, 2 a.m, people are drinking wine and vodka and eating lamb, and it's pretty, it's not crazy here, but, you know, it's exuberant and very exciting and exhausting. So that's the liturgical year kind of culminates with that feast. That's the high point around which it's sort of, the Jews have Passover, the Orthodox have Pascha. So that's the biggest feast of the year. We do Christmas in a similar way, actually. We do the vigil at night and again have a big feast afterwards. So that's a big feast. I would say that the feast that I don't know that I would say it's my favorite, but the one that is perhaps most moving to me in terms of ritual is actually Theophany, which is 12 days after Christmas. It's often called Epiphany in the Western Church. But the commemoration in the Orthodox Church for Theophany is the baptism of Jesus, not the visiting of the Magi. And the custom on that feast is to bless a major body of water in your area. There's a whole elaborate ritual of blessing of the waters. And so we go up to the Kansas River and bless it. And it's always striking to me because I think since I've been here, there's been a temperature differential of like 100 degrees between different years.
Oh, yeah.
The first year I was here, it was 70 degrees on January 6th when we went. There's been a year where it was like 20 below as well. And the sheer cold of standing out there and doing it is... It's very bracing, but it's very beautiful, and I sort of insist on doing it even if the weather is almost dangerous.
Yeah.
Because it's to be out in the natural elements is very important for our worship.
Yeah.
So that feast I find to be very moving and very expressive of maybe what's kind of distinctive about Orthodox practice is how we kind of interact with the natural world and so on. Another striking, I guess, you kind of asked for a story or example of something is about four years ago, we had a parishioner who died of cancer, and she we have plans to have a full cemetery back in our property here, and she didn't die suddenly because we knew that she was terminal, but We thought she was going to live for another week or so, and she wanted to be buried back in our cemetery. And with the day she died, which was a Sunday, we had not actually dug her grave yet. And so I finished the liturgy, and then one of our parishioners walked in and just said that Radha had died all of a sudden. One of our parishioners was building her coffin, and we were going to bury her. We took care of it all ourselves. There was no, you know, funeral home involved, you know, that kind of thing is a very, you know, natural, if you like.
Yeah.
Very intimate experience. So once liturgy was done and, you know, everyone was gone after our meal, our parishioner rushed home to finish her coffin, and I went out with a shovel and started digging.
Jeez.
And it was really intense, you know,
yeah.
to it was in the spring, so it was kind of warm. And to slowly be digging through this very, very dense clay and to know that I'm digging a grave and to be standing in a grave
for
a parishioner.
Yeah, that's...
It was a very meditative experience. And I don't know, this is a bit maybe self-important, but I kind of feel like I became a priest doing that, digging someone's grave. And thankfully, it was the next day, Monday, we had her funeral at the Serbian parish church in that you visited in Lenexa.
Yes.
And then we drove her back here to be buried and did the burial portion of the service here. And it was a very profound experience, very non-American way of doing it. And it was very authentic, you know, in that sense. So that certainly has stuck with our community.
Yeah, yeah, that sounds like a very intense, like, just spiritually, that sounds like a very intense situation.
And I think for most priests, probably their first funeral is going to strike them like that, no matter what the circumstances are, because it's something that you can't be prepared for. Like, they can't teach you how to do it. You know, you just have to be present to the people and not degenerate into some kind of, you know, false comfort to them. I mean, it's traumatic when people die, and
it is.
You have to sit with them. So,
was that your first funeral?
It was. Mm-hmm. Yes, it was my first funeral. And there was another priest, the Serbian priest, helped. I mean, he presided over the funeral service there, but then I kind of presided over the burial here.
Yeah. Do you, in this sanctuary, in this church, have you held funerals, weddings? Do you officiate any of those besides?
Yeah, we've done a wedding here, mm-hmm. Many baptisms.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't done the funeral service in this space.
Yes.
I had another parishioner who died tragically.
Mm-hmm.
The circumstances were such that we actually did the funeral service at his house.
Okay.
There were lots and lots of guests. I mean, hundreds of people came,
mm-hmm.
and we just did it in his backyard of his parents' house.
Okay.
And that was my wife and I just chanted the service there,
mm-hmm.
And he was actually buried somewhere else. But
gotcha. Can you tell me, perhaps, what have been some of the more challenging aspects of leading an Orthodox congregation or an Orthodox parish here in Kansas?
I'll preface by saying that I have found my parish to be very low stress.
Okay, that's good.
It's been an easy parish to pastor. I mean, I'm thankful because it's the first one I've been at, so I didn't know, still hardly know what I'm doing, but you know, my people are just, you know, they have issues that they need a priest for, but I've just not experienced very much of the typical kind of, you know, infighting, rancor, that kind of stuff that happens in communities.
Yeah.
And I don't know, maybe it's because I'm a weakling and God knows that I would leave if it was too hard, but so this particular community it's been mostly joy.
Uh-huh.
And the sorrow has just been the sorrow of life, not because people were being jerks and trying to have their way. You know, mm-hmm. People really just want to come here and pray and find the enlightenment of God. You know, they're not into it for any other reason, and I'm very grateful for that because it just means there are lots of stuff I don't have to deal with. But in general, Orthodoxy is not a religion that grew up in America.
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, it's very un-American, by which I mean it's not anti-American, but as a culture...
It's a very Protestant culture.
America is a Protestant culture, mm-hmm. which means a sort of disembodied culture, religiously speaking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the fundamental thing is, well, what do you believe?
Yeah.
I mean, in Orthodoxy, yeah, it's Orthodox, so there's dogma and mm-hmm. so on, but it's really about practice.
Mm-hmm.
And... being this little tiny pocket with a culture and a calendar that does not revolve with the calendar of our larger society, and with a set of dispositions and concerns and even kind of emotional ideals that do not really resonate with American culture,
mm-hmm.
we can feel it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that American culture can tend to be a bit sentimental, and certainly religion can be very sentimental in America. There's something beautiful about that. I mean, what can you say? But Orthodox spirituality is not sentimental. You know, it's sturdy, demanding, it's very forgiving, but it doesn't make you feel good, and it's not about kind of comforting you, you're okay. No, I mean, it's almost the opposite. It's
mm-hmm.
it's calling you to be serious.
Snapping you into shape.
About your life. Well, I wouldn't say snapping you into shape.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's more challenging you to be sober.
Okay.
And to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard.
Mm-hmm.
Religion can be very good at helping people not be honest. And so I'm not talking about any particular community, yeah. but the general disposition of Orthodox Christianity, with its strongly material approach to worship, its deep veneration of ancient tradition, its strongly communal notion of human identity and religion, doesn't lend itself to an easy appropriation by American cultures. It's probably a good thing. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, the last thing we need is another religious commodity to be on the marketplace, even though it becomes that too.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things that run contrary to what we're doing, and you know, we have lots of feast days.
Mm-hmm.
That in a traditional Orthodox society, you know, before the 20th century, might be national holidays. Mm-hmm. You know, not just Christmas and Easter, but there are 12 major feasts through the course of the year. And they're all major.
Mm-hmm.
But if they fall on a Tuesday, it's hard to take off work, you know?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
These kinds of things, and that's sort of where you feel the tension.
Yes.
Between two orders. But it's okay, it's a fruitful tension. You know, we don't think that our job is to somehow convert the world or convert America or convert Lawrence. I mean, our task is just to struggle with what we're given and be serious and honest and sober with our practice.
Mm-hmm.
And let that be what it is. So even those challenges, I mean, it's what we have, and I don't find it to be discouraging or even something to be changed. You know,
mm-hmm.
I'm glad for the tension in a way. It keeps us honest.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like my next question is a lot to unpack, so I'm going to skip that for now, and maybe just you and I could talk about that at some point. So I guess my last question, is there anything else you think I should know or anyone else you think I should talk to?
I don't know. I mean,
yeah.
I think
that's a very broad question.
Yeah. I mean,
so.
I think one thing that's interesting for the project is uh-huh. how very, very young Orthodoxy is in America and in Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the way that it looks in America and in Kansas is really quite different than it looks in so-called traditional Orthodox countries. And the main difference would be both the sort of distance between parishes here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, certainly in some cities like Chicago or New York, even Kansas City, I mean, there are, I think, 7 Orthodox parishes in Kansas City. But usually they're far apart, and there are very, very few Orthodox Christians in America. So it hardly constitutes an important culture here, you know, nationally speaking.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. And then the predominance of monastic culture in traditional societies versus here. There are Orthodox monasteries in America, and very beautiful ones, but not very many.
Mm-hmm.
And in the old world, as it were, monasticism is a huge part of Orthodox culture, and that difference of dynamic is pretty striking.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying it's good or bad, but it does make the American experience of being Orthodox, which is either immigrant or convert as
mm-hmm.
an experience, unique and
yeah.
quite interesting.
It is.
Interesting to study,
mm-hmm.
to sort of see how practices get translated. And what it even means to be Orthodox, you know, because on the one hand, Orthodoxy is sort of claiming just to be Christianity, you know, but, you know, those of us in the West need to wrestle with the question, well, why am I not Roman Catholic then?
Mm-hmm.
If I want, like, a traditional form of Christianity, why am I not Catholic?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, issues of language come forward. Issues of national custom come forward. Some converts really like the exotic parts of Orthodoxy, or just they love Orthodox cultures, so they'll go and learn Russian.
Mm-hmm.
They'll travel to Greece. They'll sort of do all this stuff to help them connect with Orthodoxy on a cultural level. And I mean, that can be a very good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also a potentially confusing thing,
mm-hmm.
Because identifying Orthodoxy with an ethnic style and forgetting that, like, America is its own ethnic style,
mm-hmm.
multiple styles.
Yeah.
That I'm every bit as ethnic in some way as someone else. It's just a kind of hodgepodge, whatever we call white male,
mm-hmm.
Midwestern American ethnicity.
A newer sort of immersion of an ethnic group.
Yeah. So those issues are always being negotiated by
mm-hmm.
communities, because everyone wants to be authentic.
Mm-hmm.
But what does that mean?
Yeah, is it authentic to, like, start practicing, like, Greek Orthodoxy if you've never, like, you know...
If you have no connection
yes.
to Greeks.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I totally get what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay.
So.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I'm going to go ahead and stop this then.